going within. Feel there the center of your being, heart. Breathe into your heart center. And feel there the life force flowing from your heart to all parts of your body. Open the door. Open the door that light and radiance may come in and flow out to this world. With each breath, more light, more love, more radiance flows in spontaneously without any effort. And feel it flow out to the world freely, without reservation. Now see that heart grow, its bubble would grow, that it would fill up this entire room and all the people in. Seeing this room radiant in that light, radiant in that love. Go on expanding that. Until it encompasses this entire city. Seeing and feeling that light encompassing all the so-called deserving and non-deserving alike. Seeing all as children of the one infinite Father. Continue to expand that light until this entire country is part of that life. And you feel yourself to be one with all beings who are here, both man, animal, sentient, non-sentient, all living, vibrating in that light and in that presence. Continue to expand that light until you see this whole world filled with that light, radiant in that light, that love, that light, that spirit permeating every person, every particle of space, and you are a part of that. You're both a witness and a participant. You both see it and feel it. Feel that radiance, that vibrancy. Now go on expanding that light until it reaches out to the stars and the cosmos and beyond, without limit, without boundary. Your body becomes the cosmos. You see it bathed in that radiant light of love and spirit. Refocusing your mind back on this body, feeling yourself in the confines of this body. See and feel how small this body is. Then return your consciousness back to that infinite expanse. Expanse that has no limits to it. It's universal, omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. That is your true heritage, your true home. The home of your spirit, the home of your soul. I'd like to read a poem of Yogananda's from his lessons. It's entitled The Candle of Peace. Take the bowl of my mind and fill it with thine understanding. Take my bottle of emotion and fill it with thy mercy. Take the empty basket of my soul and fill it with thy fragrant wisdom. Use my life's vessel to dip cupfuls of thy love and pour them into the desire-parched throats of others. Break the walls of my love and flood me with thine omnipresence. It is the streak of love's dawn peeping through the little opening fissure of my heart, which bespeaks the sunlight of thy love spreading over the dark dungeon of my indifference. The darkness of my love is lit by the gentle luminosity of thy love. The empty hall of my soul is illumined by the light of thy spirit. Thou art the life behind my body, the intelligence behind my mind, the love behind my feeling, the wisdom behind my ignorance. With the little taper of my love, I may read thy golden book, which lay age-long hidden in me. Thy love has been the invisible candle of peace, dispelling my darkness and showing me thy secret messages written on the pages of all hearts. I thought I would speak this evening on guru-disciple relationship. Having grown up in a Western world, the term guru is, of course, something that is a word that we're not used to hearing, not part of our tradition that we normally grow up with. It's an Eastern tradition, and people there grow up with the idea. Most families have a guru. And so there is some conceptualization of what that is, some interaction with somebody who plays that role in the family. The term guru has two meanings in it. The gu means darkness, and ru means light. And it means that light that takes us out of the darkness. It means that which brings us wisdom and removes ignorance. The outer guru that comes in the human form can come in a variety of forms. One form can be that of a teacher, anyone who elevates us, anyone who illumines us, takes us a little bit further in our path. And that is called the upper guru. And we may have many upper gurus in our life that help us. For those who are sincere on the spiritual path and desire realization, what Mother used to call going the final mile, the Satguru comes into their life. The Satguru, Sat means the eternal self. And so it is that one who is established in the eternal self and helps lead other souls into that same state of consciousness. In the mid-1980s, Mother gave me permission to give Kriya Yoga initiation to others, which is the time of formally establishing the guru-disciple relationship. It wasn't until the mid-1990s that I felt the inner direction, the inner sanction, to take up that particular role in life. It's a wonderful and a tremendous commitment, and would be a terrifying one if it was just done from a human standpoint. It is a commitment by the teacher, by the guru, to teach each one who comes to them with sincerity the means and the methods by which realization might occur. Realization, of course, is that inner illumination. There are no real words to describe it. You can't know what it is until you have some experience of it. And even then, that's not the fullness of experience. That comes through, for most of us, a gradual illumination. There are a few souls, having done the work in the past, that come and just with a touch get that full illumination. Callings like the Brahma Maharshi is an example like that. Anandi Moy Ma is another. There are some who just come and perhaps very early in their life just have that awakening. But even then, some guru, some teacher has come into their life, helped to awaken and helped to establish them in that consciousness. And so in the East, that's considered the righteous way to enter into the spiritual path, the right way. It keeps you in the right attitude. One of the things that I thought about in my own path is that through my relationship with Mother, who is my guru, that it kept me in right relationship with my spiritual path. There's a kind of a surrender that comes in all of that. There's surrender that I don't know the whole thing. I don't know what realization is. And so I surrender to a certain extent that I accept these teachings. And at first I have to accept them on faith because I don't have the realization to know that they're true. But one of the things about the path of yoga is that it's verifiable. The whole point is to come into those experiences yourself. So it's not just learning the philosophy that other people are saying is true, and we just simply accept it. All right, by faith, I accept this, and I rest with that. That's just the beginning. What we do is we accept those teachings to the extent that we're willing to employ them, we're willing to try them, we're willing to put them to work in our own life, and see what the results are. And do it in earnestness and with complete sincerity. If we're willing to do that, then we can enter into the experimental laboratory of our own life. And we can seek to prove, are these teachings true? Do they lead us to realization? Now, it varies for each individual how the path looks and how long the path takes. If you're going to start a trip to New York and you're across the river in New Jersey, that's a very different trip than if you're in Ohio or if you're in Washington State and traveling clear across the continent, major mountains. And that's a very different trip even than if you start in Japan and going to New York City. So each individual begins where their soul is at. There's just no other way around it. We begin exactly where we're at. But by employing these methods that we're taught, we can put them to work in our life, and we can start making progress. And Yogananda described the Kriya path as the airplane route to God. He says the path of devotion is like a bullet cart. You have the ball pulling this cart, and it's bumpy and it's slow. And that there are other methods as well. Kriya path deals directly with the spine and the brain. And that is the place where realization happens. It is by the withdrawal of life force from the afferent and the efferent nerves into the spinal system and lifting that life force up into the spine, awakening the higher centers. And as a result of doing that, these centers open up, which allow this realization to happen. It's an inner path. It's a mystical path. It takes us beyond reason into direct intuitive perception. Reason is always inferred knowledge. You take in information through the senses, we form judgments about things, and we use our reason to work through whatever problem is that we're encountering. Reason is a wonderful thing, and in yoga philosophy, that's called buddhi. It's the higher reasoning that man is endowed with. When buddhi is illumined with this inner light, then it captures, so to speak, some of these rays. They're like petals that capture the rays of the sun. And through that, it produces understanding. It produces realization. It's not the kind of understanding that we get through the reason process, where we work through a problem and then we think, oh, I get it. I understand it. This kind of realization that happens embodies the entire being, our physical being, our emotional being, our energetic being, our mental being. In that truth, every cell of our body resonates with that truth. And so it's not just an intellectual idea or capturing an intellectual idea. The whole being is caught up in it. And when we feel that truth, when we experience that truth, we experience it through and through, and we know that it's true. We absolutely know that it's true because every cell of our being tells us that it's true. And that is the level of realization that we aspire for and that we want. It is through the initiation into not only the methods, but into the relationship with the guru, that the guru comes with a commission, so to speak, from their own guru and from the infinite intelligence that has gone into creating everything. And that if we did not have a human example in front of us, that it would be difficult to believe many times that this is available, this is possible. If we did not have the support and guidance of Guru along the way, there are many passages, there are many blind alleys, there are many ways to get lost in all this, and some of them are dangerous. And so to have that guidance, to have that direction, both on the inner planes where the Guru resides, as well as the outer kinds of teachings, is an invaluable thing. There was a time soon after I met Mother, that I had this desire to meet a guru, and it was within about 3 or 4 months after that I met Mother. I also saw some other yogis and teachers who came through town and gave talks. And one particular yogi had come through town before I met Mother, and I had saw him speak. So I was not very impressed with him. And he had all the looks of the yogi, long hair, long beard, and all the right clothes and everything. He looked right, right? Here's Mother, you know, a Western woman. How is she a yogi? And yet, she was the one that awakened that. And she had that power and that spirit of God. It was about 2 years after I knew Mother that this yogi came through town, actually in Vancouver, and I was BC, and I was living in Bellingham. So I decided, well, it might be kind of interesting to see him now. You know, I've known Mother this amount of time, and I've had these experiences, but just kind of had that curiosity. I went to see him give a talk in front of a group, which he did. And I was as nonplussed the second time as I was the first time. As he walked out from the group, there was a parting of the people so that there was a direct line of sight between myself and him, maybe about 15 feet away. He stopped and he looked directly at me. I could feel him psychically rummaging around inside of me. And I didn't care for it. I didn't invite him to do that. It didn't feel good. It felt like an invasion. And I immediately thought of Mother. And when I did that, I felt this white light come and surround me. And as soon as that happened, he snapped his head back up straight and kept on walking. So I felt this protection by having this relationship with her. And I came to understand later that this particular fellow practiced a lot of the black magic aspects of powers and that kind of thing. And things kind of degraded from this time. So I felt wonderfully protected. And one, just not even being tempted to follow him, but also having this protection from others. That inner attunement, when we think on the Guru, puts us into communion with them. In universal consciousness, there's no time or space. It exists beyond time or space. So the moment we put our minds focused inwardly on the Guru or any of the masters at all, we form a link. And through that link, we can benefit from their protection, from their love, from their part of God. Now, one might we'll ask, why not go directly to God? Why have an intermediary? But it's not really an intermediary. It's Plato described his role as being a midwife. He wasn't the parent of the child, but he was helping giving birth to the child. And I think that that is an apt description of the Guru as well. That through the Guru, actually, a seed can be sown that helps in the evolution of the one who is seeking. And through that quickening, it comes through that the evolution takes on a much greater pace. And also, the Guru is there to help give birth. It's there to provide the right environment, the right frame of mind, the right teachings. And I know in my own case that having followed the teachings of others, I have no question in my mind at all that I had cut lifetimes of tough learning off my own path. And things I would have done and areas I would have gone into that would not have worked well for me at all, but may have taken me a very long time to figure things out. Just on. So there are just so many benefits of having that. And I certainly recognize that in my own life, the benefits of having a mother in my life has just been tremendous. It's irreplaceable. And that is one of the truly great gifts that God can give. The other thing is that what that relationship has taught me is that death of the physical body means nothing in terms of the death of the relationship. But that relationship continues on and deepens and is more profound, more wonderful. In terms of the devotee, what is their commitment? And that is that the devotee commits themselves to doing the practice, to following the teachings to the best of their ability. That any time that we get into advanced studies in any area, we narrow the area of focus. If you're going to go into a master's level study or a PhD, you narrow the area of your focus. Not because the other areas don't have promise or not good, but if we're going to make real progress, we narrow that area. And so in our meditation practice and our spiritual practice, we bring our practice down to a few techniques, things that really focus the mind and help us to go all the way into our universal consciousness. This is very necessary. And there are people who are kind of spiritual butterflies who go to this seminar and that seminar and this person and that person, and it's always on to the next thing without really employing and becoming dedicated to any one particular path. It doesn't mean that other paths don't have something to offer or are not good. But if we want to make real progress, that at some point we need to settle down and learn to focus our mind in very specific ways. It's the resistance that that generates that brings up the power of light within ourselves, that we have to come up against that resistance. There's fear that comes in there, there's indifference, there's laziness, there's, you know, stubbornness, there's all kinds of things that enter in when we enter into any kind of a discipline. And a spiritual discipline is more of that, if anything, rather than less of it. And unless we work through those things, we don't make progress. And so it's by dedicating ourselves on one particular path, taking those techniques and really employing them, working through those oppositional forces must be done, in order for us to make real progress. And unless we're willing to do that, then we'll just float kind of along the surface without really taking things deeper, without breaking through some really tough obstacles that come up in our life that prevent us from moving into that omniscient consciousness in which we're all yearning, one degree or another, to enter in, and yet we fight it. It's just the product of being a human being, that the very thing that we want, we end up resisting and not making the effort and holding back. And we want it, but we don't want it. We want it, but we don't want it. I think one of the things that these spiritual masters offer to us in their own lives, in these lives where they went all the way in their spiritual realization, is their focus of attention. That by becoming very focused and very certain in themselves of what direction they're headed in, by keeping that steadiness of practice, that intensity of devotion, that they were able to come into this tremendous state of God realization. And that each one of them are very different personalities, but that they all came into that same state of realization by having that focused attention. It's true of anything that we set out to do in this life. If we determine to accomplish some kind of goal, we have to have that dedication of purpose. We have to have that single-pointedness. And if we don't have that, our energies become dispersed. It's like the sunlight that hits a prism, and the light is dispersed. It can look pretty, but it has no power to it. It has no ability to cut through the difficulties. But if it's sent through a prism that focuses it like a laser, then that has great power to it. It has the ability to cut through delusion. With our mind, if we're able to focus our mind in that same kind of laser-like way, then we can cut through the difficulties. So all of our life supports us in this practice. There's no sense of having to go to a cave or go out of the world in any kind of a way. Things that we encounter in the world is our sadhana, is our spiritual path. The families that we raise, the jobs that we have, the social circles that we run in are all proving grounds for us in developing ourselves in a greater measure that resonates and responds to this life. Tests us, challenges us. And when we come through that, when we come into our realization, we really know we've been through something. It's been a struggle. It's been difficult, but it's been worth it. And so that the ultimate goal for all of humans is this realization. That most people, to some extent or another, are satisfied with their lives as it is. They're satisfied to live out their life, and many people lead very good lives. And they actually make spiritual progress because that's the stage of development that they're in. There is nothing wrong with it. But when we have an inner calling for something greater, for something higher, then we throw ourselves into disharmony if we don't respond. And sometimes we see people who get into real trouble psychologically, emotionally, physically, because they're not listening to the call. And until and unless we respond to that calling, that internal pressure just builds up more and more until finally breaks through our fear, breaks through our denial, breaks through our resistance. As I say, we all have that resistance to some extent or another. And so we'll all encounter it on this journey. So it's not a matter of throwing stones at somebody else and saying, why aren't you doing your work? But looking in the mirror and saying, why am I not doing my work? But hold myself accountable first. So just one last word, that yoga itself is universal. Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, you're probably all familiar with him, the autobiography of yoga. He was a Hindu who practiced yoga. But you can be Christian, you can be Muslim, you can be Buddhist, and be a yogi. You can be of no particular religion at all and be a yogi. That yoga is a set of principles that sets forth a proposition that if you do these things, that you will get these certain results. And that you don't need to push away any other religious kind of feelings or thoughts about it, that you can incorporate it into your life exactly as you are. It doesn't require you to join it in the way that you would join a religion. It merely demands that you put these things into practice. And so from that standpoint, it's the most universal of teachings in the world, because it focuses in on the human being. It focuses in on very specific practices and getting very specific results. And that it embraces all religions as fundamentally teaching the same thing. Most religions approach it through parable, by story, in an indirect way, but embedded within those teachings are yogic principles, by whatever name that you call. And to the degree that people adhere to them or don't, they either are in cooperation with those principles or they're not. There's a very mathematical kind of relationship. That if you employ these things, you get the benefit of it. If you ignore them or go against them, you get the results of that as well. It's just simply like that. And so that's the theory. That's what's being proposed. And that if we adhere to it, we'll get the benefits. I think I'll just stop there and see if there are questions, thoughts.
Why is there attention to detail or like strictness, adherence to the parameters that are set out when we make that deeper commitment?
Well, it's to protect you. It's, Yogananda said that for those butterfly type devotees who go from this flower to that flower, these teachings to that teachings, so you can get spiritual indigestion. And there's that tendency that if you do a lot of jumping around, you just never get below the surface. There's a story of the fellow who went digging for the treasure, and he dug down 5 feet in one hole and didn't find anything. And so he started another hole. He says, I guess in another place, he dug another 5 feet, 6 feet there. Didn't find it, went over to another place, dug down 10 feet. Not there. Went to another place, dug down 15 feet. Not there. dug another place 3 feet. Oh, I'm never going to find it here. Over and over and over it goes. The treasure is at 20 feet. He would have dug hundreds of feet worth of various holes, but never having gone down 20 feet, he never discovered the treasure. So when we make that commitment, it commits us to that practice. And as I say, there's resistance that comes up. It challenges us down to the very core of our being. By adhering to the strictness of the practice, by committing ourselves in Kriya Yoga to practice every morning and every night, it puts us into the arena. And by committing ourselves to being in the arena, a lot of times it's easier not to be in. A lot of times it's easier to check out. And unless we've committed ourselves to a discipline, it's easy to check out. It's easy to say, well, no, I don't feel like that. And just go through long gaps, periods of not practicing. And really, we're just standing on the edge of that, working through that resistance, and we just don't want to do the work. By committing ourselves to a practice and by a method, it puts us in the arena and keeps us in the arena. So that we get to that 20-foot depth. We work through those, you know, times when we want to give up and that we just don't want to have to do this and our fear that comes up and all the various resistive energies. So it's really designed to keep our minds focused, to keep us working, keep us going. Most of us do better when we have that kind of commitment in our lives, even if we're self-regulating it. And I don't monitor anybody's progress from that standpoint. What are you doing now? How often are you doing it? It's up to each individual, but it's their commitment. It's their promise to themselves and to God, I'm going to do this. And it's that commitment that will take us through those obstacles, through those barriers. Makes
sense. Why does resistance come up so much when making my commitment to you as my guru? Mm-hmm. When you offer forth suggestions that are for my betterment, mm-hmm. and sometimes I don't want to have to do what is suggested mm-hmm. to me. It's like, mm-hmm. I'm me, right. What relationship to me are you that I should have to listen to this?
It's always your free will to do as you will. And we can either listen or we cannot listen, we can do or we cannot. We get the results of that. And we learn from that. So sometimes we may choose not to do, but in the not doing, we get the results of that and we go, oh, I see why that's important now. So by being in the arena with the guru, we were challenged, the ego is challenged. But at no time is individual will or freedom of will challenged. That's always intact.
Mm-hmm.
And that every individual has the right to making their own decisions. The guru's focus is on helping the disciple to unfold, to help them to grow in their own realization. And it is through the teachings, it is through the interactions that comes about. And that can be a great, great help because it gives us something to bump up against. You know, when we're thinking about God as the omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent force of the universe. That's a pretty tall order. How do I get my hands on it? How do I relate to that? But if there's a living world, then that's a human being that we can interact with. And if they are who they should be, then they are operating out of that highest consciousness, and that is something for us to be able to interact with. And to, you know, really bring that to a head, because the ego is always fighting us. The ego's primary concern is in conserving. It wants to conserve its own identity. And that is that it is this body consciousness and this body consciousness in relationship to the world. When we enter into this divine consciousness, that bubble bursts. It's gone. The ego consciousness is gone. So one way of saying that is that the ego dies. In order for the divine consciousness to become resurrected. And that the story of Jesus is the story of the crucifixion, which is the dissolution of the ego and the resurrection of spiritual consciousness. It's told in parable form, in a story form, but it is every person's evolutionary cycle being talked about in a parable type form. So this resistance, this desire to conserve body consciousness, this is me, this is mine, is very, very strong. And there's a feeling inside of us that if that dies, I die. And even standing on the threshold of surrendering ourselves completely into this divine consciousness, the ego consciousness has nothing to do, pushes away. And so that's part of what has to die. That's what surrender and let go of. What we get in replacement, if we choose to surrender and let that go, is a birth into omniscient consciousness. That is really our source. That's our origin. That's where we came from. And that there is nothing about having a human body that keeps us from that except for this idea of separation, this ego consciousness. So, ego resists. It's part of the game. And it bites, and it bumps up against. But if it's sincere, and that's all that's required, is sincerity. I want this realization. It's not about giving up individual will. Unfortunately, we've had examples where it's been organizations and that kind of thing that demanded people to give up will. And you do this and you do that, and micromanaging people's lives, all of that. This has nothing to do with that. This is learning the principles, employing them, and growing spiritually. And sometimes that's also growing psychologically and emotionally. But if we're sincere, we continue on and we learn the lessons and we grow. Come into that relationship. Again, I make it clear, it's not about losing the freedom of will. Others said sometimes, I, of my own will, surrender myself to God's will. But I have never and continue to not lose my own free will in that. It's my free will to surrender. And that's an ongoing, continuous thing. So even in our God realization, we choose to surrender ourselves to that. Mostly because we recognize what a fantastic, marvelous consciousness this is that we're connecting with. It's so far beyond us in scope, in power, and intelligence. In its omniscient range of being all consciousness, that we gladly surrender ourselves. Because our own reasoning capacity, our own ego consciousness cannot even hold a candle. So we do the best with our reasoning until we can enter into that highest consciousness. It's like the person who at nighttime holds a candle in order to find their way in the dark. But when the sun starts to come up, And then the sun rises completely. Candle goes out. You're done with the candle. You can't even hardly see the light of the candle once the sun is pulled out. The human intellect is like that. It's a small candle. We do the best we can. We use our reason. And we can pray, God, you guide my reason. You guide my will. But when the sun of omniscient consciousness begins to shine innocent through us, the candle just is not an issue any longer. So that's our goal, is to have the sun rise in consciousness.
So then, what exactly are then the precepts that somebody following this path has a path to adhere to?
Mother's three kind of most basic precepts were, just in terms of behavior, it's no drinking of alcohol, no smoking, no cigarettes, and no use of illegal drugs, prescription drugs, not illegal. That's kind of big guideline. And then the practice of Kriya Yoga meditation every morning and every night.
Is that Ahamsa?
No. This is different, and it's learned at the time of initiation. And the last is just sincere effort to grow spiritually. Do everything in our power to do what we can to abide by the principles that we're learning about, by living a life of service, by learning to love everyone equally alike. It's to the greatest ability that we have to become more inward and more focused on the spiritual presence and let that be our guiding force in our life.
And so is someone not actually a follower of this path until they've done the initiation?
Well, some are already without that, but there's different forms of commitment.
Kind of like
there's
signing your card sort of thing? Is that
card-carrying
member.
Yeah. Trust you.
You know, one comparison might be to marriage. That there's a commitment that's formed by two people, but there's something wonderful about, and sacred, about bringing that commitment into a formal thing done in front of friends and family and all that. There's a power in that. It's a wonderful element of that. And so while some people in their hearts have made that commitment already, there's something wonderful about bringing that into that more formal avenue, that formal way of solemnizing.
So we're kind of here in a common law relationship and actually have that marriage.
Yeah.
I think of how interesting it is this evening, and as we do not have any other guests, apparently, think of how interesting it is that our core group is here tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, and that we should be so fortunate to have this opportunity to have, you know, those questions we've all been hanging out with each other since we were here
mm-hmm.
And I think that's a real blessing for us as, you know, our core group, right?
I find it, I just have to say, like, this for me is quite a surprise. I quit drinking in January. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that that was one of the, and I mean, I've never in my life ever thought that I'd ever quit drinking. It wasn't that I was a heavy drinker,
mm-hmm.
but it's just something that you always do, like, you have, you drink socially, and, you know, it's something that I've always done. And it, for a while, it was really awkward in certain mm-hmm. situations to explain why I wasn't doing that, especially when a friend of ours, because I don't like red wine, made a whole batch of white wine just for me.
For one thing, as the nurse, I mean, these are very practical kinds of considerations. But for one thing, as we work with the nervous system, and it becomes more refined to kind of be putting this depressive element of alcohol into our systems, it affects the nervous system, it kills brain cells. And, you know, if done in excess, can do damage to the liver. And but in terms of this body, both the physical body and the subtle astral body, are the instruments for like an antenna system. And that some people are very kind of dull antennas. They don't get much in terms of vibration, in terms of higher frequency, that spiritual vibration. But would be operating then. And so this vibration that the world offers to us is of a much slower, lower kind of rate. And it certainly has its properties that are enjoyable and we like and enjoy much of it and it's beautiful and all the rest of it. But when we go inside and attune ourselves, the very equipment that we have begins to refine itself through the practice of meditation, through harmonizing our lives with this light and this consciousness. The body becomes a more and more refined antenna for receiving these vibrations. Now, some people are very strong at seeing visions. Some people are very strong at hearing things. Some people are very strong at feeling things. And no one is particularly superior over the other, although another who went to Yogananda one time said, "Master, I don't have these visions and I don't hear these things that other people talk about. Just feel things." And Yogananda said, "To see God is good. To hear God is better. But to feel God is to be one." And so this feeling nature is our intuitive nature. It's not emotion, it's the feeling of that vibration and of that frequency. And so alcohol and tobacco and other stimulants interfere with that. They change the nervous system. They dull us to those finer vibrations. Now there are some street kind of drugs that will actually trigger the nervous system into having certain experiences where people suddenly have an experience with those higher vibrations. And they may have these uplifting spiritual experiences while on certain drugs. But as Mother explained, they're not earned experiences. In other words, they haven't come about through a spiritual discipline. So the consciousness is not able to hold that and really establish itself. And so it's something that people are lifted up into for a brief time and then they come back down. But they have no means of making that experience become a part of their lives. And there's the possibility of doing damage to the nervous system. It's like getting into a powerful rocket, taking off and having no place, no idea where you're going to land. You might land in a really nice place. You might land out in the ocean. You just don't know. And so it's a real crapshoot. And it's not an earned experience. So to become established in that consciousness, we have to do the work. We have to do the sadhana. There's just no shortcuts from that standpoint.
When we speak like an earned experience, for instance, when we come together as a group, mm-hmm. that's part of why the support to take that vibration and quiet, because you get to have that experience, and by holding it, that charge begins to remain constant, so you're familiar with it, so when you put it on, you know what it feels like.
Right.
Okay. But
many times when people have a meditation experience, that energy is being quiet around. It's, you know, not watching TV or listening to radio, or, you know, much less turning the mind inward and meditating. It creates a lot of energy. And because we're not used to all that energy, one of the first things we want to do is let it out, you know. And so sometimes after people meditate, we get chatty and quite loud. And we want to normalize our lives, so to speak. We want to normalize the energy. And Babaji explained it as doing the Kriya breaths and then getting up and going away without meditating and immersing yourself in it, just like preparing a meal and then not sitting around. So when we go through the work of going inside and holding that energy, there's a part of us who wants to get rid of it, push it out, because we're not used to so much energy. And so to learn to hold that, to reside in quietness, to hold that in stillness, is a very, very powerful thing to do. And it really helps us in the transformation. And that's why we're asked when we leave that, you know, it's nice to socialize sometimes beforehand and that kind of thing, but that when we're leaving, we carry that quietness with us. Because that's extremely powerful, and it's working to strengthen our own nervous system. That is both physical and the more subtle of the aspect. And within our consciousness. And most of us squander our life energy. We just, in the sense that we live our lives and everything is invested in this body, everything is invested in this world. And there's nothing that's retained to be brought inside. One of the definitions for tithing is to give first 10%. Right? If you think of tithing to God in life energy and bringing the first 10% of your life energy into the spine and up into the brain, then that is what you might call a virginal offering. The offering of virginal energy into the consciousness and lifting it up. The other way is to give God burnt offerings. And that is we live our lives all out here and into the world. And then we get into trouble and we say, oh God, I need some help here. And we haven't invested anything. We haven't given anything. It's all been burnt out through the senses and through the body. And so this kind of tithing that's giving 10% is giving 10% of your life force, your life energy as a virginal. It's not been burnt up in worldly pursuits, but you're giving it as this raw virginal energy going back into the spine.
Can you take us one step further in holding that charge in where we were in conversation earlier today about how I need to achieve things is to up-level with rapidity my movement.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were sharing with me about actually harnessing the prana,
mm-hmm,
and moving with it.
Mm-hmm.
Could you
one of the practices that we can practice through the day is moving at half speed. And we think if we move at half speed, we're going to lose productivity. You know, I'm not going to get so much done. But actually, if we, and it's just fully an inner kind of attitude, we just move slower in the world. We move at that half speed. And oftentimes we feel like, can't push through this air fast enough. Everything is a push. Everything is a struggle. And instead, if we tuck our tailbone, lift our sternum, and we feel as if the life force is carrying us, it's moving through us. It's moving us through the air, through the atmosphere. We can relax and we're carried along in that. And one way to do that is to slow down so that we can sense that. Now, when we get skilled at it, we can move very quickly and be moving in that flow. But initially, we don't usually do that. Then we're getting into this, I need to go faster. I need to push through this faster.
So we're not integrated.
And we wear ourselves out. At the end of the day, we feel exhausted. We're worn out. When we let the life energy flow through us and carry us, we can be very rested at the end of the day, even though we spent a whole day in activity. And by being in that inner state, we're better able to listen to the voice of intuition by being quiet inside. And when we're allowing life force to carry us through the day, we are in that quiet state. And then we can pay attention to our intuition more carefully. Even our reasoning mind works better when we're in that quiet state versus that harried, gotta get it done, gotta get it done. I'm always behind. There's too much to do. Do, 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 do. And there's no being. There's no chance for us to be. So this combines being here in the center, with the doing. May sound impossible, but it's not. When you get some taste of that experience of what that's like, it's very enjoyable. It's blissful.
And there's a groundedness feeling too?
There's a groundedness feeling as well. Yeah. Because oftentimes we get up into our head and we get disconnected from our body. I got so many things to do, and we're handling 10 different balls up here, we're juggling. We're disconnected from our body. Suddenly we're dropping a dish, we're bumping into something else.
I came to David this afternoon and I thought I was going to have to go on my puffers because I couldn't take my air. And that was when he offered the suggestion of trying that experience. And it was like you could feel that reintegration of self, just like when you tell the kid on the stage, sometimes where are you? You're not here. I'm not. Right. As a dancer, that energy and we know from our energy we're no different. And it was incredible. But the resistance on my part was equally incredible. Because I would start moving into it and then I'd speed up again. I'd start moving into it and I'd speed up again. There was real resistance because I'm so programmed that I have to speed up to get it all done. But I know full well I'm a very accident-prone person. No, I'm not. I'm not present. That's why I always get there. I'm not here. Mm-hmm. Of course, the body's been stumbling around, and I'm off someplace else. But it makes good sense. And I need very much to really stay in my body.
Mm-hmm. It has a very nice combination of grounding you in your body, and at the same time, free you, because you are sensing and feeling, experiencing this flow of life force, this beyond physical presence, that is this chronic astral energy that we all need in order to function in this world. There is unlimited amount of chronic. We are limited as human beings in a human body. But when we tap into this unlimited consciousness with this unlimited power, there's no limit to it. And that's why at the end of the day, we can be very relaxed and very calm and not even feel like work has been a pleasure. All day. We've all had experiences of that. And we've been in that flow. And when we're really in that flow, it's blissful. There's athletes have moments of that. And they remembered the whole rest of their lives, that moment when they were in the flow.
Mm.
And they were shooting baskets, and the ball just dropped in. And it's like they could do nothing wrong. That was ecstatic. And they live in that memory so for so long because they've not learned how to access that on a daily basis. It is possible for us to work in this world and be in that flow all of the time.
You had also mentioned that I had asked you at the newborn, that's where the guidance really starts to come for us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to ask many questions. The guidance is there,
yeah.
Taking me the right places. Yeah, the real. I can hear it. I can receive that.
And the outer guru, that which leads us from the darkness into the light, is there to awaken the inner guru, which is that inner light that begins to dispel the darkness of ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance is our separation from this cosmic consciousness of which we're all. And it's our real home. And we're all these prodigal children who run away. And we end up eating pig slop and thinking, you know, even the servants at my father's house are the best. Maybe I can go back and get some at least. And no, even better than that. But in the prodigal son story that Jesus told, the prodigal son made his way back to towards his father. And his father saw him from the great distance, came running out. So our part is to make our efforts to head back home. But as soon as we do that, all this consciousness and force in our life begins to support us. And it doesn't mean that it's all easy. It's not easy at all. It supports us. It takes us a long way. And we literally could not make the trip without. We don't have the intelligence. We don't have all the knowledge. It's just like, I don't need to know how my body digests food in order for me to digest food. I don't need to know how my body beats its heart and keeps blood circulating. It doesn't. We have an intelligent force within us that knows how to grow spiritually, how to prepare this body for cosmic consciousness. And once that's triggered, it goes about and it does its work. And the best we can do is cooperate. That's a wonderful, wonderful. It's fantastic. And our science has not even really discovered it. It's just on the periphery. Just a little, not really discovered. So you get to be pioneers. You get to be out in the forefront discovering this and going where I think within a few hundred years, much of mankind will be consciously making more efforts in this direction. Right now it's more of a rarity, but that we are slowly moving into that direction. It's wonderful to be
here. I mean, I don't mean any disrespect. It's from the Easter, and you know, they're a lot longer. On the flip side, it is, over here.
It is exciting, and the potential is unlimited. And the discoveries to make are still there. Not all is known. Not all is out. And so there's more to know, more to learn. Each one of us have come with our own light of life to do something in this world. Now, not everybody, you know, has world-shaking kinds of things to do. Sometimes it's leading our life, but it's important to do that. It's important. And sometimes, you know, I think of Brother Lawrence, who wrote a little book called Practicing the Presence of God. This is wonderful. Little book. It was a letter that he wrote to somebody who requested him. He was a friar. I don't think he was a brother in a monastery. He was, you talk about somebody who had the dropsies. He couldn't do anything right. They finally put him in the kitchen. I think they had maybe some metal pots or something. He couldn't just scroll number easily anyway. And he was clumsy, and everybody kind of, he was kind of a butt of jokes and all of that kind of thing. But he got into this idea of practicing the presence. Practicing the presence himself. What a marvelous image. A marvelous soul. And that book today is published all over the world. Who was the Pope then? Who knows? You know, who was the wealthiest guy in town? Who knows? But here's this humblest of guys. You know, he's kind of a big, clumsy guy. Everybody's kind of making fun of him, and he's a lovable guy, but, you know, they kind of make fun of him in the monastery there. He wrote the letter on condition that the fellow that he wrote it to would shorten no one. So, obviously, that didn't happen, because that book is published all over the world. So in living your life, you never know. You know, what impact you will have and what your role is to play. It may seem like a small role, but you never know. You never know. And even these yogis who practice in these caves up in the mountains, they send out a vibration that goes out around this world. When I was up in the Himalayas, up by Babaji's cave, I was up on the rooftop, the second story of this ashram, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, full moon, brilliant. The stars were so many, so brilliant, about 8,000 feet high. And there's this wonderful plant there called Queen of the Night that was down on the ground. I'm up on the second story, fourth. It only smells, and the fragrance, the aroma was coming up, and it was so sweet and intoxicating, just lovely. One small problem, the cobras like to wind themselves around, they like the smell too, so you want to be careful when you're walking around in the night then. But just as extraordinary, these vibrational storms. The only way I can describe it is if you've ever been in a kind of a gully or something, and suddenly a gust of wind just kind of comes through and just blows through, and it comes up and then it dies down.
Dust devil, here it goes.
Yeah.
Okay.
These vibrational storms were just coming down out of these mountains, and I could feel them coming right by where I was. It's like being in a windstorm, only it was no wind. It's vibrations. Coming down and coming down through these gullies and going out to the world. And these yogis, tremendous souls that are up in this area, by their vibrational thought, through their intention from these caves, were sending out these magnificent vibrations out to the world to help uplift it, help quicken thoughts. And so, unknown to the world at large at all, and yet they secretly, silently send out these vibrations to help change. It's beautiful.
And when you say about the vibration storm, the energy storm, I have a sense in my mind's eye of the aurora borealis, but in vibration form.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could see it, that's what it would look like if it was looking through there.
Mm-hmm. It didn't have any sense of color, that kind of vibrancy, that kind of aliveness.
It was just, if I were to try and put it to a picture, and that would be, I can have that sense of joy and seeing that happening.
So even whatever we're called upon to live our life, whether it's a quiet life, or a more openly kind of expressive life, however that is, it makes no difference. It's that purity, it's that inner light, it's that inner purity, and how that blesses the world. And when you attune yourself to it, you become a blessing. It guides your actions, guides your thoughts, it guides your feelings, and you become a blessing to your family, to your community, and it emanates out from you just through the vibration. So if we're looking for ways to help this world, to change this world, to bring it into harmony with truth, life, love, brotherhood of man, it's the very highest thing. And Papa Ramdas says you can do no good until you have a vision. And I think the meaning in that is that you can do no predictable good. Because from our own human reasoning, we try to do good, but we never know for certain, is that the best thing to do? But when you're attuned to divine consciousness, it by definition is connected to the whole. And so when it operates through you, it is operating for the highest good of everyone. So your actions, your thoughts, your words are all attuned to the highest good of all. And there is nothing greater. And that's when you know that you can do not of your own will, not of your own thoughts. We don't have that capacity as human beings. We have the capacity of the instrument. It is the best life possible.
Can I ask how you were going to teach us Raja Yoga? Is that right?
There are four main branches of yoga. And one is Karma Yoga. Karma means action. And it has to do with being of service and keeping your mind on God. Mother Teresa of Calcutta is a wonderful example. She saw the Christ in everyone and sought to serve Christ in everyone that she met. That would be one example of karma yogini, female yogi. Bhakti yoga is a yoga of love and devotion. It's a feeling, that awakening of love and devotion. It may be for an objectified aspect of God that you have a particular affinity for. Or it may be just divine love itself and its vast expression of impersonal spirit. The third then is Jnana Yoga. And in Jnana Yoga, it's yoga of wisdom. It's using your intellect to separate out that which is God from that which is not God. It's a lot better at identifying what's not God than what is God. But as you whittle away what's not God, you finally end up with what is God. And so you just keep saying, not that, not this, not this, not that. And I'm not this body. I'm not these feelings. I'm not these thoughts. It's a very exacting path, using the mind, whittle away, cut away that which is not representative of the highest. Final then is Raja Yoga, which is called the Royal Path. And it is the path that includes Hatha Yoga, that we are familiar with, the physical postures. It is also the pranayamas, which is the movement of prana, life force, and of meditation techniques. And it is called the Royal Path. This that I'm going to be teaching this next weekend is a Raja Yoga. It is learning to free the body of blocked prana within the body, and the physical body within the subtle astral body, and then to also charge with this life. Something that you'll be able to use both in a more formal, kind of regulated kind of a way. It's also something that you can use daily, very easily, very quickly, all through the day, responding to any tension, any pressure, any inharmony or imbalance that you have in the body. It's very powerful, but very simple.
So how can I help, like, for me, my the two things I'd like to give the gift to my body would be, like, my, to lessen my weight,
mm-hmm.
so my body wouldn't have to work too, so hard, and the fibromyalgia.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, fibromyalgia is part of your client, too.
Well, it's the physical body reflects the subtle prana astral body. And so, when we get blockages within the pranic body, and Chinese medicine deals with that in terms of meridians and other kinds of healing technologies that also deal with these. But when we, through experiences in life, end up with blocking the energy, it's like an intricate passageway of highways and then entrances and exits and surface streets. There's 72,000 nadis in our astral body. When we have some trauma to the body, we can end up with a roadblock in some of the nadis, which then, of course, spreads out, because when we get stuck energy in one area, it tends to spread out and cause problems for other areas as well. Much like a freeway system, it's blocked up and then creates backups all over the place. By clearing these areas, it brings, it restores the balance and harmony within the subtle astral body that then gets reflected in the physical body. So that by restoring the balance within the pranic body, oftentimes it helps restore balance in the physical body. So the proof will be in the pudding.
Does it have a reflection in our emotional
brain
as well then?
Absolutely. And mental.
Mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional.
So one of the things, if you want to get a head start on this, is making three lists that we'll be using this weekend. And one list is the physical issues that you would like to let go of. Emotional. Make them three separate lists. Emotional issues, feelings, emotional nature that you would like to let go of. And the third is mental, disturbing thoughts, unhelpful thoughts that keep circulating through that you would like to let go of. And so we can start making those lists, and we'll be utilizing those.
How many things you want to put down on
your
It's for your eyes only. So you can put down as much as you want, and you can go into as much detail as you want.
And is it, do you lessen it by putting down too much? You know, lessen the ability of something because you dilute it, because you're trying to go into a new direction?
Well,
you know, you can be the best judge of that if you start losing yourself, you know, what am I trying to say? You probably wandered off a little bit. But for emotional, for instance, I would just suggest just sitting down and just start writing. And don't edit it with the thoughts, just let the emotions write out what it wants to write out.
Is this something that we bring with us, or is this something that we just do for ourselves, saying to?
We'll bring that with us, and we'll have three envelopes, one marked physical, one marked emotional, and then marked mental.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a running start on that.
And we could do this again, like, say, 5 or 6 months later. We could do this again, right?
Mm-hmm.
We could set our alternatives.
Are you saying we could do it again, or we could try again for the first 12, 16 years?
No. things may come up.
Oh, I see.
There. We were successful, but we discovered more.
Okay.
You've really tailor-made a meeting for us. I feel very much that this is specifically tailor-made for
us.
Yeah, it's like pretty cool, man. Right?
Mm-hmm. You're the faithful ones and the ones that are coming. Makes a difference. It's a way to change. You know, spiritual life is difficult. And especially if we feel like we're kind of out on our own. Ultimately, it's always a solitary. And the ultimate analysis. We live with ourselves, we're accountable to ourselves. That's where it resides. How wonderful when we can have some kindred spirits who are also journeying, that we can join together with and create a bond with and bring the best. You know, Jesus said when two or more are gathered, there's some power that comes together when we come together as a group that reinforces our own spiritual life, our own spiritual goals, helps focus the mind, keep us centered, keep us going in the right direction. So it's quite wonderful to be able to come together, to have the results, and take away a little bit from that isolation, and I must be wacko and way out there, you know, why am I the only one? And I remember when I first came to Mother, and I didn't know anybody else in the group, and then I moved away, and I was in Eastern Washington for a couple of years, back and forth. And really feeling, gosh, there's just nobody who really shares this with me. But gradually through the years, here and there, and then a few more, and kindred brothers and sisters coming together. What a wonderful feeling that. As I say, ultimately it's always a solitary path. We're accountable to ourselves. But it's really wonderful. We can grow together, celebrate together. So no problem. So I think it's wonderful. Going to watch a video.
would you speak to us a little bit about where are from now until you return again to us, what that looks like a little bit for the
second? We'll leave that until Monday.
Okay.
I think Monday it would be nice for us to spend a little time talking about what you would all like to see, what would be supportive, what would be helpful, and how it's just supportive kindred spirits, you know, you can be together in a way that's most helpful, most useful.
You really have a little homework.
you're all sincere, and that's the primary goal. When we have sincerity, everything else can be. And there's respect, and there's sincerity, and there's openness, communication. Everything can be worked out. You know, we're all different personalities, and that's a strength, and that's also sometimes a challenge. But the strength is one of the things that I was shown one time inwardly was when God is in His unified consciousness. All in the oneness, the formless, beginningless, endless aspect of Himself. There's no giving one to the other because it's whole and complete. There's no second. But when we come here, we operate in these divided selves. And here, we need each other. Because not one person has all the expertise or all the life energy or all the intelligence that is needed to make the whole thing work. So it's here that God within you can give to God within others and vice versa. And that cannot happen in the absolute spirit. And so what a wonderful opportunity and a play to be able to be here and support each other and to give to each other. And that no one person has all the marbles. That what's required is the light within each one of us to be brought and to be added and to be shared. And that makes us greater, makes us more whole. And I thought that was marvelous. This is the place to be. And not to be afraid to give or receive. Because if we, one of the things, another talk one time, he said, oh, I just have such a hard time receiving. He said, you know, if you don't receive, you're denying that other person privilege and joy. You know, you're right, because I love to give. And if somebody doesn't receive it, or if nobody received it, I wouldn't have that opportunity. I wouldn't have that joy. So I worked on it. You know, it took a little while. And to be able to receive it, knowing that I know I love you. And I know when somebody's giving from the heart. Because they want to give. And I know the joy. So it's allowed me to be a better receiver. So it's both in giving and receiving. And to allow ourselves to give. Closing prayer. It's his mother's prayer. In yoga thought, there's the feminine and there's the masculine. And that the feminine, in a spiritual sense, is the divine mother, who is divine nature, all outward expression. Divine father is spirit, absolute, not expressive multiplicity, see, but that inward consciousness is full, complete, without a second. And so both are active, both are equally God's nature. It's a way of talking about this absolute nature, this nature that's expressed as all creation. It's not nature. It's quite a beautiful way to interact with the spiritual consciousness and energies. Again, it's just a way of speaking about it. Lifts us up too, because in each one of us is the divine mother and the divine father. And women come into this world representing the divine mother, expression of that, and for the divine father. And the ideal is to balance those energies. My mother was the most balanced person I ever knew. She had that wonderful mother love and compassion and feeling. And she also had that strength and wisdom of the masculine. She had both of those. Great. She's a wonderful example of someone who really balanced herself. I think sometimes in listening to her kids, perhaps you feel the power that she spoke with, and it's a lot of power and a lot of authority. What you don't get is her hugs at the end. That is that feminine mother love that just overwhelmed you. That was so loved. So loved. I feel the loss of that parts of your experience that, that love, compassion, and that motherly caring that you have. You have that insight which speaks to us. Please repeat after me. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace, blessings, and